Good day. Today is Sunday, 30th November 2025, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button if, once you've watched the programme, or such part of the programme as you want to watch, you've liked what you've heard and want to signal that fact. Now, let me begin today's programme by briefly discussing again the situation around Venezuela, because it looks now, again, as if we are very close to the start of a military operation by the United States, whose purpose will be regime change, the removal from power of President Maduro. So briefly, the President of the United States in a Truth Social post has essentially announced the closure of Venezuelan airspace. He's made comments about how this is intended to act against drug smugglers and traffickers and people of that kind. But if you read his post carefully, it seems to me that he clearly leaves open the possibility of a military attack by the United States against Venezuela with the intention of overthrowing the Venezuelan government. And interestingly, the Truth Social post also seems to open up the possibility for some kind of operation on land, that is to say, in Venezuelan territory itself. Now, this comes after reports have appeared in the US media of a conversation between President Maduro of Venezuela and President Trump of the United States, which apparently took place a number of days ago, over the course of which, apparently, according to the Wall Street Journal, President Trump told President Maduro to resign and indicated that if President Maduro did not resign, the United States might take military action to remove him. And in addition to these various signs that the United States is preparing for military action, there were reports late yesterday evening in the media that US aircraft are now very active, flying around Venezuelan territory, and also the well-known hawk, Neocon, person who is played a major role in US Latin American policy for decades. I can remember him being active in the 1980s when he was running policy in Central America in El Salvador and Nicaragua on behalf of President Reagan. Anyway, this gentleman, Elliot Abrams, who was also working for President Trump during Trump's first term, has written a very belligerent article in which he basically says that there would be no problems overthrowing the government of President Maduro, and all of the worries that people have are completely wrong, and it is absolutely something that the United States must do, should do, and must do. That at least is the way I read that article. Now, given that Elliot Abrams has worked for Trump in the past, given the role he has played in US foreign policy in Latin America, given the fact that I believe that he has connections with the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, though I'm not absolutely sure about this, but that's what I've heard, I suspect this article is intended, again, to prepare the ground for this military operation which is to come. So all of the indications point to a military operation by the United States being prepared, and one which will be shortly underway. And certainly the United States now has enormous striking power in the region of Venezuela. We have 7 Arleigh Burke destroyers with apparently 250 Tomahawk cruise missiles between them. We have the Gerald Ford, which is America's most modern and biggest and most powerful aircraft carrier. We have F-35 fighter jets positioned in various bases around Central America, including Puerto Rico. There's amphibious warfare ships in the area too. And, well, it is highly likely, though, of course, this we don't know about, that the CIA is active within Venezuela itself. I've been told so, and I believe so. And I've no doubt that all kinds of preparations and work to conduct a military operation in Venezuela have been underway for some time. And, well, there have been other signs too that the president, Donald Trump's focus is increasingly on Latin America. He has recently pardoned the former president of Honduras, Mr. Hernandez, who has been convicted and has been serving his prison sentence in the United States for massive drug smuggling into the United States whilst he was president of Honduras. And he has actively supported, openly supported, a candidate in the election, the current presidential elections that are taking place in Honduras, a candidate who represents Mr. Hernandez's party. So Mr. Hernandez, as I say, convicted of drug smuggling, the president has pardoned him, even as the president announces that Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, is basically the leader of some massive drugs smuggling cartel. Many people have pointed out the absurdity and the contradictions of the two. But the key thing to say here is that one gets the sense that the president and his officials, or at least some of his officials, are mostly focused on re-establishing American geopolitical control of Latin America. And of course, the whole story about using drugs, about combating drug smuggling in the Caribbean and elsewhere, has basically been a cover story put together by the United States in order to justify what is ultimately a strategic and geopolitical play. Now, to be very clear, there is no legal justification for what I suspect the United States is about to do. There is no conceivable way that Venezuela represents any current or immediate danger to the United States, military danger. The story that Venezuela is the linchpin of drugs trafficking into the United States has been widely discredited. I appreciate there are still some people who stick to that belief. And I can say for a fact that certainly drugs do circulate in Venezuela. And I believe that there is a certain amount of drug smuggling that takes place from there. But it is not the main route through which drugs reach the United States. And it is not the main route through which drugs reach Europe. So nobody, I think, takes this especially seriously. It's a cover story. And a military attack on Venezuela looks like it's coming. And its objective is geopolitical. And, well, I'm going to explore the geopolitical objectives and rationale more thoroughly after the attack comes. But briefly, I think the United States most definitely does want to get control of Venezuela's enormous natural resources, its oil, first and foremost. I think that the United States does want to push back strongly on Chinese influence and BRICS influence in Venezuela, in Latin America as well. And probably the support for a particular candidate in Honduras's election is part of that. And, well, I've also heard that the idea here, there is also an idea that control of Venezuela will stop oil deliveries to Cuba, Venezuelan oil deliveries to Cuba, and that will open the way for regime change in Cuba too. Now, as to that, as I've discussed in previous programs, the Russians have made clear for some time that they are willing to provide Cuba with oil, but the Cubans, for the time being, have been sticking with the oil they are getting from Venezuela. I think that there is at least a possibility that Cuba, if there is a crisis in Venezuela, will indeed turn to Russia again, in which case I think there is also a small possibility, that the Russians will exert themselves more strongly on behalf of Cuba, with which they have a historic and very strong relationship, and whose military they know much better than they know the Venezuelan, and that we could actually start to see Russian and perhaps, who knows, Chinese troops deployed to Cuba as well, with the Russians perhaps reminding President Trump and his officials of the agreements made with President Kennedy back in 1962, which ended the Cuban Missile Crisis. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss this in detail in this program because the attack on Venezuela has not yet happened. I expect that it will, but I will say one thing, which is that I have been expecting this attack on Venezuela for some time. I've been surprised that it has taken so long to take place. It's just possible that the president continues to dither between contradictory advice provided by one wing in his administration and another wing pointing out that an attack on Venezuela would be deeply unpopular with his political base, and that apparently war games about this conflict, which have been conducted in the United States, call into question the US's ability to retain or maintain control, effective control, of Venezuela after the Maduro government is overthrown. Anyway, it could be, it might just possibly be the case that we're still seeing a game of bluff, the United States trying to bluff and frighten President Maduro into walking away. But to be honest, I don't believe so. I think that we've gone so far now that it is all but impossible for the president to back off. As I've said on previous programs, were he to do so, he would lose face. And I think this is something that this president is unable ever to accept. Anyway, we'll see what happens. I'm going to make a guess that we will know certainly by the end of next week, probably within the next few hours. Let's turn now back to the perennial topic of these programs, which is the conflict in Ukraine. Now, as I am making this program, a delegation from Ukraine, headed by Rustem Umerov, who is, by the way, also under investigation in Ukraine for corruption. A delegation headed by Rustem Umerov, and which includes amongst its members Kirilo Budanov, the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, and by the way, one of his subordinates, is apparently in Florida, where it is expected to meet and perhaps is already meeting the Americans, Rubio, Witkoff and Kushner, to discuss the present state of, well, the media in the West still calls it a plan, But Putin made it clear that he considers it to be no more than talking points. And to repeat a point I've already made before, and which I really do want to reiterate again, Putin has also made it clear that there has been no agreement on any part of any proposal on any of the points that have been made. There has been no agreement of any kind so far between the United States and Russia. I continue to read articles, intelligent, well-written, good faith articles that presuppose that the Russians and the Americans have reached some kind of agreement with each other, and that this is reflected in the 28 points. Putin has denied this, and I think that this is a denial that ought to be taken seriously, just saying. But anyway, put all that aside, presumably there will be discussions between the Ukrainians and the Americans about, well, I'm not even sure what they're going to be discussing now, because we've heard there was the original 28 points. I say the original 28 points, but bear in mind that the Russians perhaps received some information from the United States that was different, because the original reports about this plan, the ones that appeared in Axios and in the Financial Times, differed significantly from some of the points in the 28 points, the discussion points that Putin is talking about, has been talking about. And to reiterate again, it seems that even the 28 points exist in different versions, and we must not assume that the one version that we have been that we have seen, which is the Ukrainian version published by the Ukrainian MP Alexei Goncharenko, is either the only one or the correct one. These are assumptions that many people are making that, it seems to me, go beyond the facts. The Russians have themselves said that there are multiple versions of different talking points and plans floating around, and this might even be true of the 28 points. Anyway, I'm no longer sure what exactly is being talked about, because we heard about the 28 points. Then it was supposed that they had gone down to 19 points. Then yesterday I was reading about 22 points. It seems to change literally from one day to the other. But anyway, the Ukrainians are coming along to the United States, to Miami, and they're going to talk about it. And it's very unclear what the Americans are doing when they're going to talk with the Ukrainians about these things. Are they going to try to get the Ukrainians to agree and to sign up to every point that the Americans are going to propose to the Russians? Withdraw from Donbass, Ukraine abandoning its commitment to join NATO, Ukraine agreeing to caps on the size of its armed forces, Ukraine carrying out major domestic changes to its political system and revising its constitution. Is that what the Americans are expecting the Ukrainians are going to commit to in the meeting today? Or are we going to see instead that which Eve Smith has talked about previously and talked about so long ago, in effect another negotiation about the wording of the 28 points, with the Ukrainians making their own, putting forward their own ideas, and the Americans trying to split the difference between the Ukrainian ideas and the Russian ideas, and perhaps tilting more towards the Ukrainian ideas and rewriting their 28 points again to bring them closer to the Ukrainian position? Because if it is the second, and by the way, for the record, I think it is, then we are going to get ourselves in a more difficult position, or at least the Americans are going to find themselves in a more difficult position when they are facing off against the Russians early this week when the team, presumably Rubio, but definitely Witkoff and Kushner, fly off to Moscow to meet Putin. So the whole thing is extremely unclear at the moment, and perhaps it's unwise to make too many guesses as to what might come. I would say that the rhetoric coming out of both Moscow and Kiev seems very uncompromising. Zelensky has made a whole series of statements which, taken together, still seem to me to show no real willingness on his side to engage in any compromise on any of the fundamental issues whatsoever. He is supposed to be having meetings with Shmigal, the new Ukrainian defense minister, to revise Ukraine's defense strategy in some way. Given that Ukraine is being defeated on the battlefronts, we can understand why that might be important and necessary at this time. But anyway, he seems to be talking in a way that implies his expectation that the war is going to continue. And as for the Russians, well, none of the really important Russians have spoken. I say really important, that's probably unfair, but none of the members of the Security Council, the Russian Security Council, Putin, Lavrov, Lavrov and others, and none of the major figures who've been involved in these negotiations up to now, Ushakov, Dmitriev, none of them have said very much that's really very interesting over the last 24 hours. But the Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson did actually say something very interesting indeed. She said this, and this is in connection with the resignation of Yermak, Zelensky's chief of staff, which I discussed extensively in my program yesterday. She said that this is all theatre, this is all a PR exercise, that the Ukrainian government, the Zelensky regime, is like a deflating balloon, basically dropping ballast in order to stay afloat, which is an interesting take on the Yermak affair. And then she said that what really needs to happen, and what one day basically will happen, is that all of these people will be put on trial. All of them. Zelensky himself as well, from what I can understand. And not just for corruption, but for the many other crimes that they have committed, both over the course of the war crimes and all of the rest, and before it as well. Now, I remember right at the start of the special military operation, the Russian Defense Ministry actually published a statement saying that all of the perpetrators, all of the various crimes that the Ukrainian government has committed or has alleged to have committed, will inevitably be punished, but for what they have done. And that was, as I said, a statement by the Defense Ministry. It's never been said by Putin himself, but we can see now that the spokesperson of Russia's foreign ministry is repeating that too. It's a rather chilly statement, to put it mildly, to be made on the eve of negotiations. And it reinforces the sense I have that the Russians are in a very uncompromising mood at the moment. To recall, a few days ago, the Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, said that Russia had made all the compromises that it can. It is in no mood to make any more and will not do so. And no one should expect that Russia will compromise in any way from its red lines or give up on any of the objectives it's set out at the start of the special military operation. And it's clear that Ryabkov's comments, which were made in an address to the Duma, the Russian parliament, were a warm-up act for Putin's own comments at the press conference he gave in Bishkek, which I have also discussed at length now in several programs, two programs, in which Putin made it clear that there is no agreement of any kind in existence between the United States and Russia. He made it fairly clear that Russia ultimately expects the four regions to be transferred in their entirety to Ukraine. His words seem to me to contradict completely the widely held belief that the Russians have agreed to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions if the Ukrainians pull out of Donbass. What Putin actually said is that there will be a ceasefire only if the Ukrainians pull out of all of the territory, the Russian territory, what Russia considers to be Russian territory, which they currently occupy, which of course includes Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. And Putin also said that there has to be recognition, at the very least by the United States, of all of the territories as Russian, and that he was as baffled about the distinction between de facto recognition and de jure recognition as everybody else is, and that this has to be clarified further in negotiations. Based on what Putin said, it's clear to me that what the Russians are expecting when Witkoff and Kushner arrive in Moscow is a set of discussion points that they can agree to discuss further in detailed negotiations with the Americans. And the Russians are making it fairly clear now that they expect the discussions to be, the negotiations, the substantive negotiations, to be with the Americans as opposed to the Ukrainians, and obviously not with the Europeans. And that provided these discussion points that the Americans come with, the 28 points, the 22 points, the 19 points, whatever is hammered out in Florida today between Rubio and the Americans and the Ukrainians, whatever's hammered out today, provided that is something that the Russians feel that they can usefully talk about, they will not agree to that, and they will not accept an agreement, a full agreement about that this coming week. What they will want instead is properly organized negotiations with proper negotiating teams, led in the Russian case by the Russian Foreign Ministry and headed by a seasoned diplomat, but also including Ushakov and Medinsky, who heads the Russian negotiating team, who has been speaking with the Ukrainians in Istanbul. And the Russians will want those negotiations to take place in some formal setting and in some formal manner. And they expect and assume that the Americans will set up a proper negotiating team to work through all of these various points as well. Now, I'm not sure that this is understood fully in the United States, but if Rubio, Witkoff and Kushner come along with a Ukrainian signature to some document and bring it with them to Moscow and ask the Russians to sign that document and then say that there's an agreement and a settlement to end the war, then I think that they are setting themselves up for a major disappointment. Because if you read carefully what Putin and Ryabkov said then that doesn't seem to me to be at all what the Russians have in mind. Anyway, we'll have to see. It's going to be a curious week of diplomacy. There's a number of small points I do want to quickly touch on, however, before I finish this rather, well, this discussion of the diplomatic situation. Firstly, I've seen that there is a narrative now that is beginning to appear and which has been circulating and which some people have been seeking to refute, that there's been some major clash between the foreign ministry, the Russian foreign ministry, and Putin himself, that Lavrov, in his various recent interviews and press conferences, has criticized the use of back channels and has been insisting on formal negotiations and that kind of thing, and that this is somehow a criticism by Lavrov of his chief, Vladimir Putin. I have to say, I think this is a misunderstanding. I think that not just Lavrov, but also Putin himself have been deeply frustrated and exasperated that this entire discussion between Russia and the United States has been conducted entirely through back channels. The reason it has happened that way is not because anybody in Moscow wanted it, but because the Americans could think of no other way than that in order to discuss, conduct negotiations of this kind. It could be that Trump likes conducting negotiations in this way, through back channels and informal advisors like Witkoff, or it could be that Trump has a deep and, by the way, justified mistrust of the State Department and doesn't believe that they would conduct negotiations properly if they were given the instructions to conduct them. Or, and I think this is the most likely explanation, that Trump himself doesn't understand or realize that negotiations can be conducted in any other way than the one that he prefers, which is through Witkoff and informal meetings and things of that sort. So I don't think it's the Russians who wanted the negotiations to be conducted in the way that they have been. It is the President of the United States who has insisted on conducting negotiations in this profoundly unconventional way. What I think has happened is that the Russians have basically played along with it up to now because they realize that Trump does not have massive diplomatic experience behind him, and for that reason, they've cut him some slack. But if you go back to Putin's comments in Bishkek, my sense is that the Russians have said, okay, we've done all that up to now. Enough's enough. We have to have this thing done in a proper way through proper negotiating teams, because otherwise, this is never going to work. As Putin said, I don't know of any other way that this can be done. And I don't think it can be done in any other way. That was what Putin said in Bishkek. And of course, what he meant was that negotiations from this point on, now that there's some basic points that can be discussed, negotiations from this point must be conducted properly and conventionally. Again, to repeat, I'm not sure that the president or his officials fully understand this. And it's not impossible that when the Russians point this out in Moscow, the Americans might be taken aback and might be deeply surprised, and that this might in fact be construed as a rejection of the entire process by the Russians. Whereas what the Russians are actually trying to do is to put this process on a proper track. Anyway, we shall see. And the other very brief point I want to make is about Europe, because the Europeans clearly have no essential role in this diplomacy any longer. And there's been a lot of discussions about this. There is a truly brilliant article on Cautilia the Contemplator's Substack blog, which talks about the way in which the Europeans have now developed a kind of pathology about Russia, and that this is creating a major political and diplomatic crisis in Europe. The title of it, by the way, and it's absolutely worth reading, Europe's Hysteria and Strategic Unraveling, Russia a Symptom, Not Cause. And the title is right, and the article altogether is insightful. I would actually say brilliant. Anyway, the Europeans have been cut out of negotiations completely, and in no small part because they've done this to themselves. As a number of people have pointed out, Wolfgang Munchau, for example, at Eurointelligence, the Europeans have never engaged the Russians in diplomacy. No European official, apart from Viktor Orban, it seems, and occasionally Robert Fico, travels to Moscow anymore. There is no European envoy who travels to Moscow on a regular basis to meet with Putin and Lavrov and Ushakov and to discuss things and to discuss this conflict with them and to try to understand the Russian position. There was a couple of months ago a big argument at a European Council meeting, I think it was, at which Emmanuel Macron proposed that such an envoy be appointed. Kaya Kallas insisted that she was that envoy. Apparently, there was ridicule, even at that meeting, of the idea that Kaya Kallas should be the person conducting diplomacy on behalf of Europe with Russia. Macron promptly appointed himself to that position. He's had one extremely unhappy telephone call with Putin, which went extremely badly. Jonathan Powell, Keir Starmer's chief of staff, has had one telephone call with Ushakov, which also went extremely badly. And apart from that, there's been nothing. So if you opt yourself out of diplomacy, if you refuse to negotiate, which is what the Europeans have been doing, what place is there for you in negotiations? Why should anybody, why should the Americans and the Russians, who have at least been talking to each other since Trump was inaugurated president of the United States in January, why should the Europeans waste their time when you're not prepared to engage in negotiations, serious negotiations, yourself? So anyway, now, there have been a number of other developments which are not exactly related to the Ukrainian conflict, but which do have bearing on it. Firstly, and it's been completely unreported in the media in the West, Saudi Arabia and Russia have agreed, apparently a temporary period, but one which could quite easily become permanent, a period of visa-free travel by their citizens to each other's countries. This builds on Russia's and China's agreements to grant each other visa-free travel for their citizens. Now, this move by the Saudis is important and interesting, and it strongly suggests that the Saudis are not in the mood to distance themselves from Russia, even if that is what the United States wants them to do. And I understand, for the record, that MBS, Mohammed bin Salman's visit, the visit of the Crown Prince and Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, which is what he is, to the United States, which took place about a week ago, didn't go especially well. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, pressured MBS to join the Abraham Accords and to establish diplomatic relations with Israel and to normalize relations with Israel. And MBS said no and said that Saudi Arabia could not do that until there was actual genuine progress towards establishing a Palestinian state. Saudi opinion would tolerate nothing less. So the Saudis, obviously, they still want to maintain good relations with the United States, but they have now come to value their relations with Russia, and they have taken an important step towards deepening them. Anyway, the other step that's been taken is by China, or at least by a company in China, and we have this now thanks to the Financial Times. The Financial Times is reporting that a major Chinese company, which is involved in the business of producing drones, has now bought itself a big stake in a Russian company that is also involved in producing drones. Now, I don't know that this is particularly important or very interesting in itself. The Financial Times is luridly saying that this is a further sign of the tie-up that is taking place between the Chinese and Russian military industrial complexes, which is one way, I suppose, of looking at this. But the key point about this story is that there's been multiple reports in the media in the West that after the American sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, India and China were beginning to distance themselves from Russia, that the Chinese companies and Indian companies were no longer placing orders for Russian oil, and that this was having an effect on economic interactions altogether between these various countries. I have seen absolutely no credible, secure evidence that any of this is true. Bear in mind that on the 4th of December, Vladimir Putin is flying to New Delhi, and he's going to have a massive meeting, a summit meeting, with Prime Minister Modi of India there. Everything about China-Russia relations suggests to me that they continue to deepen and develop in science and economics and technology, and of course, in coordination of foreign policy and in military relations also. And it's perhaps worth saying that on the same days, the same set of days when Witkoff and Kushner and perhaps Rubio will be in Moscow meeting with Lavrov and Putin and Ushakov and all of the others, and Dmitriev, no doubt, too. On those very same days, Wang Yi, the foreign minister of China, will also be in Moscow, and he very likely will be meeting with the same set of people, with Putin and Lavrov and other important Russian officials whilst he is there. So, contrary to Western belief, that there is some sort of distancing from Russia. It's extraordinary how the narrative of Russia being isolated and marginalized in international relations continues to appear on regular intervals in the media. The reality actually is otherwise. Anyway, with all of that, let me now turn to the topic of the war, because the war continues and the fighting continues, and we've had some important news over the last 24 hours. And the single most important piece of news was provided this morning by the Russian Defense Ministry. And they provided this information in connection with the fighting that has been taking place in the Pokrovsk area. And briefly, this is what they said over the course of their discussions of the fighting in Pokrovsk. In Pokrovsk, assault groups of the Second Army are going on advancing in the eastern part of the town and the Dinas district, as well as continuing to mop up Rivne. Assault groups entered Grishino. Now, Grishino is a village to the southwest of Pokrovsk. It is the base area that the Ukrainians have been using to launch their various counterattacks on the Russian forces that have encircled the Ukrainian garrison in Pokrovsk. In fact, that garrison is now apparently mostly located on the territory of the neighbouring town of Mirnograd. It looks as if the Russians, however, have now managed to break into Grishino itself, into the village, in other words, which is Ukraine's forward base in the Pokrovsk area. So there's been a lot of reports over the last couple of days that the Ukrainian high command has basically given up the idea of trying to rescue the encircled Ukrainian garrison in Mirnograd, and that in fact over the last couple of days they have started to withdraw military units from the Pokrovsk area. And in fact there is apparently video footage which appears to confirm that the Russians have recaptured, or at least are now in secure control of northern Rodinska again. And there's also apparently footage and film which shows that the Russians are once again advancing towards the other town of Belitska, which lies immediately, well, some distance in fact, to the north of Rodinska, and which the Russians briefly threatened during the fighting of August and early autumn, but which it seems, under the weight of Ukrainian counterattacks, they retreated from. So that leaves only Grishino as a forward base for the Ukrainians in the Pokrovsk area. And it does look as if the Russians, taking advantage of this redeployment away from the Pokrovsk area of Ukrainian troops, are now taking advantage of it and are breaking into Grishino as well. If Grishino is captured, then the whole battle for this area, not just for Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, but the entire battle for this whole sector will have ended with a clear-cut Russian victory. Now, the Russians, when they talk about the situation in Pokrovsk, and say that Dinas district and that they're mopping up Rivne, this again suggests very strongly to me that the territory, the buildings, if you like, in Pokrovsk, which is still under Ukrainian control, have now been significantly reduced, and that the Russians now indeed do control pretty much the whole of Pokrovsk, and that the pockets of Ukrainian resistance in Pokrovsk have now been limited to just a few small areas. Now, they also discuss, the Russians also discuss the situation in Mirnograd. They say that in Mirnograd, the 51st Army's assault detachments continue to push the enemy out of the Vostochny and Zapadny districts and the southern part of Mirnograd. We've had actually some video footage, apparently. I haven't seen it myself, but from what I understand, it now looks like all of Mirnograd, southern Mirnograd, is basically under Russian control. A major micro-district, a built-up area in the centre of Mirnograd, has also been captured. There is one fortified position in Mirnograd that the Ukrainians still have left. And once that's fallen, that's it. That's the end, the final end of the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd battle. So that's the situation, it seems, in Pokrovsk-Mirnograd. There has also been a continued advance by the Russians in the Zaporozhye area. Now, according to Russian reports, according to Ukrainian reports as well. Let's start with the Ukrainian reports. The Ukrainians have admitted, they've admitted over the last couple of days, that the Russian army has advanced into Gulyapolye and that intense fighting is taking place inside that town. And the Ukrainians themselves acknowledged that one of their units, I think it was a brigade, that had been tasked with defending Gulyapolye, broke down, and that many of the men fled, and that this enabled the Russians to roll up Ukrainian positions west of Gulyapolye and to break into the town and to capture the eastern areas of Gulyapolye and to fight their way to the centre of the town. The Ukrainians, however, say that new units, tougher, more experienced units have been deployed to Gulyapolye and that the situation has been stabilised and that the Russian advance inside Gulyapolye has been stopped. The Russians say that, yes, the Ukrainians have indeed redeployed troops to Gulyapolye, but that the Russians have not been fully stopped. Their advance has slowed within Gulyapolye, but it continues. I am not present. I am not there. I don't know what the true state of the battle in Gulyapolye actually is. No doubt we will find out soon. But I don't believe that at this stage in the war, any stabilization of the military situation in any place on the battlefronts, from Ukraine's point of view, is going to be anything else but temporary. The Russians will undoubtedly capture Gulyapolye. I don't know how long it's going to take. Maybe it will take a few more days or weeks than seemed to be the case a day or so ago, but it is going to happen. Meanwhile, the Russians also say that in order to stabilize the situation in Gulyapolye, the Ukrainians have been obliged to redeploy troops from other areas of Zaporozhye region, notably from the town of Orekhov, and also from a village called Pokrovska, which lies to the north and which is an important fortified position at the northern end of a fortified line that the Ukrainians seem to be trying to create. In which case, it could very well be that these redeployments might achieve a temporary stabilisation in Gwyllapolia, but they could open the way for a much more rapid Russian advance in other places, in which case Gwyllapolia itself might find itself surrounded, and instead of a perhaps less experienced Ukrainian brigade being driven out of Gwyllapolia, allowing the town to fall, some of Ukraine's few remaining best troops will find themselves in Gwyllapolia, but will be trapped there, and we will have another cauldron. Just saying. So, there is a sense, at least I have this sense, that at this stage in the war, the Ukrainians always find themselves confronted with bad choices. Whatever step they take in order to stabilize or to prevent a collapse in any one place ultimately works to their disadvantage and makes their situation worse. Now, there's been a lot of other reports about fighting in other places, in Siversk especially, and in Liman. Apparently, there's again reports that there is fighting in Liman. There are also a lot of reports about Russian advances in an area to the east of the Oskol River called Barova. Now, from what I can tell about this area, it's the one remaining stretch of territory around this town of Barova, east of the Oskol River, which is still under Ukrainian control. Its importance, to the extent that it has any importance, is that apparently it opens the way for an attack on the town of Izium, which lies to the west of the Oskol River. The point is that if the Russians, who have now captured Kupiansk in the north, are also able to capture Barova and Liman, then the way is open for them to recapture Izium, and that the Ukrainians would not be able to defend themselves for very long there. And I've already explained that if the Russians recapture Izium, which they controlled for a certain period of time back in 2022, then following the fall of Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, and before long, Konstantinovka as well, the Ukrainian forces in Donbass, in the two Donbass cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, would be threatened with encirclement, with an actual cauldron much bigger than any other cauldron we have seen in the war up to now. Anyway, all of that is also going on up in the north, and there are reports that in Kharkiv region, the Russians are now preparing to advance south from Volchansk, and that they're still rounding up the Ukrainian troops in the fields east of Kupiansk. I wonder how many of these men are left. I would not be surprised if, given the accounts I'm getting of their plight, there have been deaths from exposure there as well. But anyway, I'm not going to get into the details of this because obviously, as I'm not there, I don't have exact details. But anyway, there's talk of more operations by the Russians in Kharkiv region as well. Now, there are two other very intriguing pieces of information that have come my way over the last couple of days. The first, which apparently is confirmed, is that the Ukrainian authorities have now apparently ordered an evacuation of all their government agencies from the town of Kherson on the west bank of the Dnieper River. And I noticed that there was an article which appeared, I think, in the London Times, in which it described the city of Kherson having now become effectively a ghost city, the civilian population has entirely evacuated. Well, the article, this article in the London Times, seemed to me, again, preparing the readers, British readers of the Times, for a battle of Kherson, which is about to start, and for the possibility, the prospect of the city of Kherson, the biggest city that the Ukrainians were able to recapture from the Russians during their spring, their summer and autumn offensives of 2022. In fact, by far the biggest city that the Ukrainians have been able to recapture from the Russians at any point in the special military operation, that Kherson might slip back at some point under Russian control. Now, as I said, there's been rumours and talk about Russian landings in the Kherson area on the west bank of the Dnieper River, even of the Russians establishing some kind of presence in the city of Kherson itself. There's been barely any video footage at all, and I've been puzzled myself as to why the Russians would want to do something like this at this time of year, when climatic conditions, weather conditions are just about at their worst for an amphibious operation. And when, before long, by the way, they're going to be made even more complicated still because of the ice, which is going to start freezing the river up. But anyway, that's one piece of news that we've had, which is interesting and which might point in the direction of events, of coming events soon. And there is another very intriguing piece of information which I've had, which takes us back to the fighting in Pokrovsk. And this relates to the operation that was commanded by Kirilo Budanov, in which all sorts of special forces troops on helicopters were located, inserted, if you like, special forces troops were inserted into the Pokrovsk region, only to be caught in the open by the Russian drones, and with most of them, perhaps even all of them, being killed. Well, I have now had what I consider to be an authoritative account of this operation. And perhaps, I should say, not just authoritative, but definitive as well, in the sense that I believe this account completely. Now, I'd speculated that what the Ukrainians were trying to do was to try to extract someone from Pokrovsk, from the area of the cauldron of Pokrovsk. Someone important had been trapped in Pokrovsk, and the Ukrainians wanted to get this person or persons out. Well, I'm told that wasn't really the purpose of this operation. That what had happened is that the Russians had deployed an elite sniper and drone unit to precisely this part of the battle lines, and that this unit was working with extreme effectiveness in closing off access by the Ukrainians to their encircled garrison in Pokrovsk, and was preventing the encircled garrison inside Pokrovsk from exiting. And it's important to remember that this whole incident took place in early November, at a time when the cauldron had only just been established, and that this was a desperate attempt by the Ukrainians to eliminate this sniper and drone unit by deploying special forces to the area. But what in fact happened was that the Russians either got wind of the whole operation or were at any rate prepared, and in the end, instead, it failed. And if the video footage is true, it failed catastrophically. So it makes it all sound a little bit like that famous sniper duel that is supposed to happen in 1942 during the Battle of Stalingrad. But anyway, it seems it was something like this. It was more a military operation than an extraction one. And I've had so much information provided about it now that, as I said, I believe this to be the case. So that's the military situation. There has been one very concerning development. In my program yesterday, I discussed the fact that there'd been two attacks on two oil tankers in the Black Sea. These were oil tankers that were steaming towards the Russian port of Novorossiysk, which has also been under attack by Ukrainian drones. And these two tankers experienced severe damage and indeed were crippled. I believe, I've heard some claims that one of them has sunk. And the initial reports, which came out mostly from Turkey, implied that they'd struck mines. I said in my program yesterday that there were also reports circulating all over the Russian internet, including from people like Rybar, claiming that in fact the tankers had been attacked by drones. And a few hours later, the Ukrainians admitted that that was what had actually happened, that these were drone attacks by Ukrainians. In fact, they were these sea drones. They weren't air drones. They were unmanned boats, if you like. That these were drones which had been launched by the Ukrainians to attack commercial shipping trading with Russia on the Black Sea. Now, the Western media, which has wanted to downplay this incident, refers to these two tankers as Russian tankers. Now, it is absolutely true that they are tankers which were traveling to a Russian port, probably to take on oil there. But my understanding is that there was nothing Russian about these tankers. Neither tanker was Russian owned, and neither tanker flew under the Russian flag. One of the tankers flew under the flag of an African country. So, these tankers were belonged to a third country, to third countries, to nationals of third countries, and flew the flag of third countries, countries with which Ukraine nominally is not in conflict. And yet, Ukraine conducted a deliberate attack on these tankers on the high seas. Now, there's been some speculation as to who was responsible, and there's been widespread assumptions by many people that the Ukrainians could not have done this by themselves, that they would have needed help from one of their Western backers, and perhaps one of those backers was the British. Well, I'm not going to say that I think that's unlikely because I think it's very likely, but I do want to make the point that I don't actually know about that, and I don't want to speculate further on something I have absolutely no information about whatsoever. What I will say is that this is a really extraordinarily reckless act and a very, very desperate one. The first thing to say is that whilst Novorossiysk is indeed a place where Russian oil is shipped from. It is also the terminus of oil exported by Kazakhstan and other Central Asian countries. There is, as far as I know, no way of saying definitely that the oil that these two tankers would have taken on as cargo would have been Russian or Kazakh oil. Just saying. Kazakhstan is furious by this attack. They have made strong protests to Kiev, both about the attacks on Novorossiysk. I don't think they've yet said anything about the tankers, but I would not be surprised if privately they're making complaints about the attacks on the tankers as well. President Erdogan of Turkey is not going to be happy about this either. He has a well-established and highly profitable energy partnership with Russia, and he absolutely will not want disruptions to the energy trade on the Black Sea. He also must know that there is a real risk that the Russians could take retaliatory action. I have discussed in many, many programs that the view that the Ukrainians have won some great naval victory on the Black Sea is a myth. The Russians, if they chose to, could impose a blockade on Odessa, Ukraine's great commercial and grain port, at any time they choose. They could do so by simply announcing that any commercial ship that sails to Odessa puts itself inside a war zone and will be treated by Russia as a legitimate target. Now, the Russians have not done that because, as I've discussed in program after program, when in the summer of 2022 they appeared to think about doing it, they came up against strong opposition across the global south because global south countries were worried that a blockade of Ukrainian grain exports might result in a spike in the price of food, which for many global south countries remains an existential issue. Well, the Russians were not going to antagonize their global south partners at that time. But now, after this attack, they might turn round and tell their global south friends, well, look, the price of oil is as existentially important to you as the price of grain is. And you see that we have held back from attacking ships involved in the grain trade, but the Ukrainians are showing no such signs of restraint. They're attacking ships which fly the flags of global South countries engaged in the oil trade. So if the Ukrainians are going to do this, then you can't seriously object if we retaliate by acting against Ukrainian shipping or shipping going to Ukraine in response. I am not saying that the Russians are going to do that, but I would be extremely surprised indeed if President Erdogan and his officials, and President Erdogan is, after all, the person who wants to keep the Black Sea open, if President Erdogan and his officials are not very worried and angry about what has happened. It's also possible that players in the Western oil industries will not be happy about this either. If this is Kazakh oil, which is being disrupted, then bear in mind that Western oil companies are themselves buyers, major buyers of Kazakh oil. Anyway, I suspect that for the moment, the Russians will respond as they always do. Instead of acting aggressively in ways that might upset their friends in the global south, they will provide escorts for tankers going to Novorossiysk. They will, they've shown that they're prepared to provide convoys to sort out naval escorts for commercial ships in the Baltic, and they can obviously do that also in the Black Sea too. But the possibility of retaliation can never be completely away. One would must assume that the Ukrainians themselves understand this, and well, in light of that, the fact they have done this extraordinary thing, to my mind, what it shows is how reckless and desperate in their attempts to gain leverage over the Russians, they have become. They must be sensing now that their drone offensive against the Russian refineries has been a failure. Notice that the Western media no longer talks about shortages of gasoline in Russia. That story has just vanished. In fact, the Western media isn't talking very much about the attacks on the refineries either. They probably are starting to realize that early reports that India and China were going to turn their backs on imports of oil from Russia were wrong. They are under pressure. I discussed in my program yesterday how they're under pressure on the battlefronts. They're under pressure from Trump, who wants them to start making concessions that up to now they've never been willing to make. They're under pressure because their European friends are struggling to come up with a coherent kind of financial package to keep things going. And of course, within all of this has led to the political crisis in Kiev I discussed extensively in my program yesterday, which has had its first big name victim in the person of Andrei Yermak. Well, given all of this, they're now trying to take steps like this to at least strengthen their position and to gain some kind of leverage over the Russians, over the Americans, over whom exactly, I am not sure. But what I will say is that this was a step which will not in the end do the Ukrainians any good. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. Please also check out our new Substack site, the Duran Substack site. Also, if you want to support our work, you please do so. You can do so via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you wish, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.